accession number 22342, rail 10.
Trooper Bowdler, rail 10. I think you're saying that the Traggles became waterproof eventually because the canvas tightened as the
that's
water
right.
wet through.
The fibres expanded and formed a waterproof membrane. Anyway, we'd hang them on the tanks, and of course, with all our charging around, great big clouds of dust all, constantly being kicked up. These Chargals got a layer of mud on the outside, and even in the warmest weather, you could get one of these things down and pour some water into your piala or cup, enamel mug that you had in the tank, and it would be icy cold. Wonderful.
Must be very refreshing to have cold
absolutely,
water.
Absolutely, yes, an absolute lifesaver. Mm. And it, it not only was it cold, but it was also clean. You know, the mud didn't get through. Mm. But from the outside, you'd say, I'm not going to drink anything in there. But it was quite all right. It was a wonderful invention, really. The Chargal. Never forget that.
Were you allowed unlimited quantities of water, or was it on ration?
Well, no. If there was none there, you didn't get any. Mm. If it was there, you did. Mm. And if a stream was badly contaminated, it sometimes meant that a tank had to be sent out with the water truck to find supplies.
When you were in the box, did you have difficulty in getting water supply? You're saying it was dry season. And
well, it was, but there was a stream running through or alongside the box, which had, at that time, pretty clean water. There were not many dead about at the time, and it was pretty clean. So we could fill up there. Boil it first, of course, which you did, of course. The only time we drank water was in tea.
Yes.
So it had to be boiled to make the tea. So we didn't have any vegetable cooking to do or anything like that until later when we got the K rations.
But they were dehydrated, weren't they?
They were dehydrated, but they didn't take a lot of water to reconstitute them. Mm. So I can't remember water being a problem, quite frankly, which surprises me. The Naff River was ran very near to the to the box, and we could, if necessary, send the water bowser, as we called it, out with one of the tanks or a couple of or a trooper tanks, would escort it to the river, cover it while it filled up, and bring it back to the box. So water wasn't really a problem.
How did you eventually get out of the box?
Well, this business of fighting our way out went on until we'd taken the hills immediately surrounding the box, and those we did put units on. They were occupied by our units, infantry, and Indian regiments, I suppose, mostly. They occupied the hills to stop them being retaken, so the box was secure. And at that time, the box was getting terribly overcrowded and a very unpleasant place to live as well, what with all the dead lying around and that sort of thing. And so we had to expand it and find new territory outside of it. So we started going out on tasks. We would be ordered out probably before dawn, some of these jobs, to go and attack a certain feature. And having done that, we would then harbour, or camp, wherever we could find a reasonable situation to do so. Somewhere sort of backed by a hill that we could set up guards on, and with a bit of flat ground to tuck in and a bit of cover.
What did the Japanese do when these attacks went in? Did they ever retreat, or did they fight?
I fought to the bitter end. You had to kill the blighters to
kill all of them.
Oh yes. Later on, when they were a bit demoralised, and they started running short of supplies and that sort of thing, they did retreat. You would see them retreating, actually see them legging it, which was very unusual. But in general, their attitude was die for the emperor. And they did. They fought to the last man. You had to kill every one. Very few prisoners. I can only remember one prisoner in the box. A special cage was constructed to put him in. And he was very subservient. He bowed every time you went past him. And they were a funny lot. They really were, the chaps. Just couldn't understand them.
How was he caught then, this single?
Oh, he was shell-shocked. Yes, he was out of it. He couldn't defend himself. He was totally shell-shocked, and he was brought in, given treatment, and treated respectfully, you know. But he had to be put in this cage for security reasons. But it used to annoy the CO enormously, because he could see he was an officer of high rank, and he used to fawn every time he went anywhere near him. But even to us, he used to bow. I just could not understand their mentality at all. They were extremely brave or stupid, I don't know, but they would do things that you wouldn't get a British body doing, you know. They really were. I mean, they would charge, well, like these guns about, a 5.5 firing at you. You'd find the nearest hole, wouldn't you?
You would if you knew what was good for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. But not them. No, they'd come on.
Did they then actually make a direct attack on the 5.5 guns?
Yes.
Or was this just the usual thing?
Attacking the box in general.
Yes.
Not on the 5.5s that deliberately. Yeah. But on the box in general, yes. It was under constant pressure, the box was, for the first couple of weeks. And as you say, we eventually started getting farther and farther out of the box, and the box became an administrative centre, a very unpleasant one, but nevertheless it was.
Was this expansion happening because more British troops were coming in? And I mean, were these more stragglers coming into the box and providing the resources?
Well, there were stragglers coming in all the time, yes. Apart from that, it got so unpleasant in the box that it wasn't a good place to be, you know. I mean,
must have been unhealthy having so many soldiers in the same area.
Yes, that's right. And not only that, so many dead bodies about, you know. I mean, it really was awful. Happily to say, most of the bodies were Japs, but it made it very unpleasant. And the sooner we could get out of it, the better. So we started ranging farther and farther afield and taking on different tasks, you know. Instead of rescuing people, we were actually attacking the Japs.
Supporting the people.
Supporting the infantry and actually attacking the Japs. And the outcome is known, you know. I mean, eventually we took Busidon, we took the tunnels. The road from... there was a road which ran from... I think it was Akyab, a small port on the coast, the Arakan coast, and a road ran from it through to Busidon, this village. And I don't know where it went any farther than Busidon. I should imagine it must have done. But the road went through the Akyab range by means of a tunnel. They tunneled through it. And that was an absolute fortress, this tunnel. And it had the equivalent of our 5.5s in it. and they used to wheel them out, let off a few shots at the box, and then get back into the tunnel before our artillery could respond. And I had a very good friend killed by that gun. Bertha Dong Bertha, we called it. Used to come out every night, let off a few shots, and then back into the tunnel before any. In the end, it was silenced by a fantastic tactic. We wanted to get a tank near enough to have a go at it when it came out.
How far away was it from the box?
From the box?
Yes.
It was about, I suppose it was about a mile away, something like that. Didn't take long for the shell to land. You heard the bang, the thud from the gun, and almost immediately a shell landed in the box. Almost immediately, and yet it couldn't fire flat, so it must have been a howitzer of some sort, because it had hills to negotiate.
It had to be a very high trajectory.
And it had to drop into the box because the box was surrounded by these other hills. But it was pretty accurate. Yes, it was. It was pretty accurate. But I had a friend in another tank called Graham, Scotsman, who I was quite friendly with. And we used to sit around talking and various things. He was killed. He took shelter under his tank. And the one of these great big shells landed straight in front of his tank and blew his head off. So that was the end of poor old Graham. He was buried in the box. But Bertha Dong Bertha was silenced by an amazing tactic. To get a tank near enough to have a go at it, we took a troop up as near to the hill immediately in front of the tunnel as we could get it, and then because of the sound of the engine would have betrayed its presence, you wouldn't believe a thing like that would have a starting handle, but it did. It wasn't intended as a starting handle.
Yes,
it was intended to turn the engine over
to loosen it up.
Well, you'd get a hydrostatic lock if you didn't.
Yeah,
because of the. Some of the cylinders were facing down,
yes,
and the oil would drain down. So you had to give it a few turns with a handle before you started it. And the handle went in the back here.
Yeah.
And on this night, we got this tank, if I can just show you, got this tank coming up the reverse side of the hill, being wound up on its handle in bottom gear.
God.
And
that
a couple
must
of
have
guys,
been very, very hard work.
Very hard work indeed. Mm. And we did it in... I didn't. I wasn't involved.
Mm.
But they did it in relays. And they got the tank up to the top of the hill.
They moved it silently then.
It was moving silently. No noise at all. Mm. And it, daylight came, and there he was, perched on the top of the hill, waiting for them to come out. And when they came out, they blasted it with a 75. And that was the end of Bertha Dong Bertha. So... that was a great relief to get rid of that, because it was in an impregnable position. I mean, the tunnels were eventually taken, and they were an amazing sight. They were full of ammunition dumps and sleeping quarters. You know, it was a fortress.
And what sort of positions did they have defending the tunnel?
Well, they defended it from the hills around it, you know. I mean, they...
Well, they dug in with bunkers on
higher
ground.
Yeah, it's the usual thing, yeah.
What about Bertha Dong itself? Were you involved in attacking the village?
I was.
What happened there?
Well, we didn't take it. Not on the action that I went in on. We had a go at it. It was very strongly defended.
Was that on high ground or was it in the valley?
No, it was surrounded by paddy and that sort of thing.
What sort of village was it? What were the buildings?
Oh, it was a sort of, in general, a mud hut and bamboo. Well, most of the houses were bamboo or wooden construction. You very seldom saw any brick. And it was mostly bamboo, with bamboo thatching and palm thatching and that sort of thing. But some of the houses were very nice, you know, they were well equipped. But it was, how big would it be? It was about the size of we called it a village, but it was about the size of a small town, I suppose. You know. And the natives had all gone, they'd gone.
There were no Burmese about?
No Burmese about. They'd disappeared into the hills or wherever. Mm. Anywhere where there wasn't any Japs. And the place was entirely occupied by Japs. Mm. They had some vehicles there, some tanks. They had nothing that could worry us, tank-wise. Their tanks weren't very good. They had one tank which was quite reasonable, but they weren't very well trained in the use of them. They used them more as mobile artillery. Which we eventually did ourselves, but we'd had the background training of tank warfare, and we knew all about hull-down positions and, you know, choosing your ground and everything like that, and the various techniques of driving and getting over obstacles and that sort of thing, which they didn't have, because it appears that they would just send infantrymen in to take over a tank and run it and do whatever they did with it.
Didn't have a special corps then?
No, no. Mm. And so whenever you came up against Japanese tanks, and I personally didn't. I never came up against I never fired on a Jap tank. But the ones that did, those who did, it was no contest, you know. They just didn't put up a fight. They were no good.
What happened then when you did your attack on... on the village?
On the village, well, it was a softening up job, really. Mm. We went in, and I suppose if the resistance hadn't have been so stiff, we would have had a go at taking it. But with the forces at our disposal at that time, we couldn't. We just didn't.
What forces did, you know, when you went up there for this attack?
Yeah.
What was the scale of force that went?
I really couldn't tell you. I don't know. I wasn't privy to that information. There were quite a few good old faithful grinders were behind us.
Yes.
Of course, but they weren't intended to attack anything, really. I suppose they would have done, but their main job was to protect us.
Mm. How close to the village did you get?
They were our guardian angels.
Yes.
Oh, within throwing distance of it. Mm.
Yeah. What sort of defences did the Japanese have there?
The usual things, the bunkers under the houses. Oh. You know, they would dig down under the houses, and most of these houses would be on stilts anyway.
Yeah.
For the monsoon period. Mm. And the paddy fields would all be flooded, of course. So most of them were built on stilts, not very high stilts, with bamboo matting around them. Mm. And they could very easily conceal themselves in there. You know, they were very difficult to take. Mm. Very difficult to take.
What form did the attack take? Did you stand off and use your main armament, or were you trying to force your way into the streets of this?
No, at that time
village?
We used our main armament.
Yeah.
We had a go at any Japs we saw with machine gun. And we did see quite a few. In the main, it was trying to blow the damn place to pieces. Mm. You know, that's what we were at the time.
Did you have any artillery support for this softening up attack?
No.
It was just you and your infantry.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Did the infantry go into the village at all? Or
yes. Well, they tried, but they were driven back.
Yeah.
They were driven back. So, and of course they'd got some well-sighted 47mm anti-tank guns in there, and it would have been suicide to commit the tanks for going down these narrow streets without very thorough infantry support or artillery support.
Mm.
So our attacks were sort of probing, really. And Boothadon was taken after I left the box, after we left the box.
Roughly how many tanks were there then when you were doing this probing?
Oh, squadron strength. Yeah.
What was the squadron strength at that time? Because you said you'd lost some tanks to the dive bombing.
Yes, we did.
Mm. Any idea how many were left?
All told, I suppose, in the battle of the box, I suppose we lost no more than half a dozen tanks. Which, out of a squadron, isn't severe losses, really. Mm.
That's nearly half, though, isn't it? If you've got
15
in a squadron.
Well, three tanks in a troop. Mm. Four troops in a squadron. Mm. One, two, three, and headquarters group, troop.
Yeah. It's about half, about 50%.
Yes. That's true.
It's quite a heavy...
Well, they weren't. I suppose they weren't all destroyed. They were. They were damaged so that they couldn't. Oh,
they couldn't work.
Work, but at a later stage, they may be put back on the road again. Mm. You know. As I say, I was amazed at the way they stood up to what they had to take these tanks. But British tanks would have done it better. The only thing is that a British tank would have had nowhere near the firepower of these. They were absolutely incredible things, they really were. And they were like a block of flats coming along, you know.
Yes.
You were so high.
Could see them a long way away.
Yeah. Mm. But I'll give it to the Yanks. They could, if one of those could put up a heck of a concentration of fire, really could. And it was just the thing that was needed for that situation, as it turned out. Because we didn't fight any tank battles, no tank battles at all.
How did you get out then eventually? What route did you take out of there? Was it the same
route? Oh, back over the pass.
You went back over the same.
Yes. After supporting a number of attacks like that,
yeah.
You know, on Boothadon and various features outside the box, the monsoon was coming on, or due to come on, and they wanted to get us out before we all got bogged down. And so the order came to go back. Oh, the pass was retaken, by the way. C Squadron forced their way up from our side.
So they'd come from the far side of the...
No, our box. We were on the box side.
Yes.
We forced our way up from our side.
Oh, right.
And A Squadron and the rest of them came up from the coastal side.
Now you said that...
And we met at the top.
Yeah. You did a number of attacks before going back over the pass.
Yes.
Do any of those stand out in your mind as having any particular features?
Not really. It was all more of the same, you know. I mean, one hill is very much like another. And mostly it was attacks on the hill. Mm. There was one particular one, and I can't remember the name of the feature now. But... Yes, it does, as a matter of fact, now you come to mention it. We were lined up in front of this hill to support an attack. The attack went in, and the usual thing happened. We got on top of the, or near to the top of the hill with the infantry as we could. And the Japs were all down the sides and at the back slopes of this thing. And... the thing was being shelled and bombed with Vengeance dive bombers. It was a pretty big feature, must have been. And came the order to advance. I shall never forget it. Driver, advance. And the only way to advance was into this massive explosive shell, smoke, flames. And I thought, God, I've got to drive into that lot, you know. And it was... our own fire. But of course it packed up when we got there.
How far ahead of you was it when you were given the order to push on?
Yeah, about a quarter of a mile, I suppose. Yeah.
So there's a safety margin.
Yes. Mm. And so we went charging down there flat out, and as I say, into this round the side of the hill, up round the back, and down came the mortars, all the muck imaginable. But yes, it was taken, that hill was taken. But that did, yes, it stuck out in my mind, because when we got round the back of the hill, a wounded swaddy was brought up to my tank, and he was very badly wounded. He had a terrible stomach wound, and he was laying at the side of the tank, and he was calling for water. And of course we couldn't give him any, because stomach wound, you're not supposed to do that. So we just had to, and he died alongside the tank. But I felt that very badly, because I would have loved to have given him a drink. It would have killed him, but he was going to die anyway, poor devil.
But you couldn't have told that, could you? From
I couldn't tell that he was going to die, although I must say the wound looked fatal. You know, there's a lot of blood and that sort of thing. But, and then we caught, on that particular occasion, what made it memorable for me was, for once, we caught the Japs in the open. They had other prepared positions on a hill immediately behind the one that they'd been driven off. And they were running between the two hills. And we caught them in the open and really duffed them up. We gave them a right old going over. And that was at close quarters. So we won the day. It was a good day as far as we were concerned. And our campaign, after the Battle of the Box, and that was a battle, it was a real battle, after the Battle of the Box, we were sent out on raids, more or less, you know, to capture capture hills and that sort of thing.
What sort of distances were you going out?
We were going probably 1, 2, 3 miles, something like that, and then back again.
Using the box as a base?
Using the box as a base, we collect ammunition and fuel from the box, and rations, that sort of thing.
Were you still having to defend the box at that time?
Yes, it was still having to be defended. It was being raided regularly on a regular basis. And the Japs, having realised that they'd run out of steam at the attacking front, were all tending to come back. But they were in a pitiful state, some of them. They were starving and disease-ridden, and goodness knows what. They were in a terrible state. But they still fight. They still fight. And if they were ordered to attack, they would attack.
You're saying that you had to fight your way up the pass to clear it on the other
side. Yes, we did.
Yes. What kind of defence did the Japanese have in place on the pass then?
They had, in the time that when we went from going over the pass one way to coming back over it the other, they had constructed the most amazing defences. Damn great bunkers and slits. They'd cleverly sighted, you know, just round a bend, you know. You wouldn't see it until it got round the bend. And
you were on top of it.
By then it was too late and they were firing at you. But, so that was it. And, of course, the infantry backed you up. We did. Made several attempts to get up the pass, all of which failed. And it was, I think the Japs ran out of steam. That's what.
They were running out of supplies then to keep
the Japs
going. Yes.
Yes. I think that was the reason we managed to retake the pass.
Had they carried out any demolitions or put any mines?
Oh yes, mines. There was plenty of mines, but yeah.
On the pass.
Another thing they were good at were roadblocks. Of course, there was plenty of material there for roadblocks. They could fell trees. They could dynamite a pile of rocks down onto the pass. They could pull burning vehicles across, you know, and line machine guns up on it and that sort of thing. Well, they're very clever at all that.
How did you deal with those sorts of obstacles?
We had certain tanks with bulldozer blades on the front, and they were very, very useful. They weren't there to fight. They were there to clear obstructions. We also had bridging tanks, by the way, Valentine bridging tanks, which were also very useful for crossing streams, chongs, as we call them.
Were they armoured troops, or were they engineers, those, the crews in those tanks?
I think they